Welcome to the Tracking Connections podcast, and thanks for listening.
We feature voices from around the world sharing stories of working intentionally with deep nature connection in ways that transform lives, families, projects, and communities. I'm Sarah.
I'm Aiden.
And I'm John.
And we are your hosts from Living Connection First.
Hi, everyone. This is Sarah. Welcome to Tracking Connections podcast. This is episode 19.
Yeah. Hey, everybody. This is Aiden. And I'm excited to be here today to talk about the quiet mind.
This is John, and I'm really excited to talk about this topic of the quiet mind. And there's so many places we can go on this topic. And gosh, I feel like maybe we'll revisit it, maybe more than once, because it feels kind of endless. It feels like a portal. You walk through it, and there's all this expansiveness. But I'm thinking specifically about something, Aiden, that you said before we got started today, which was, how do I know if I have it, right? And I thought, well, that's a really great lens to look at all of these attributes of connection, which we talk about these things as, you know, the goals of deep nature, people connection is these attributes. So if you're a mentor, you're watching for these attributes to emerge in the person you're mentoring as a sign that you're on the right track, essentially, right? And that once they start to emerge, then you want to help get those attributes embodied in that person so they stick, you know, so they don't just happen when we're having fun in nature with friends and then back to work on Monday, then you hit Monday syndrome and all that goes away. It's like it never happened, you know. But it's really good for us to know if we have the quiet mind. And there are examples of the quiet mind, you know, there's certainly, thankfully, for the popularity of mindfulness, the impact of, you know, of Buddhism around the world and the mainstreaming of things like yoga and mindfulness practice and all these fantastic tools and even these apps that, you know, give you cool things to work on to get you into a more calm, quiet space. And is that the same thing as the quiet mind? And let's just say there's an overlap, but the quiet mind has some more dimensions to it that are sometimes difficult to pin down. So I think through some storytelling, we'll be able to get to at least, you know, I like to say, you know, I'm aging myself here, but there was a show on called The Invisible Man, you know, and whenever he was in the room on the TV show, you couldn't see him. So it was a funny job for the actor, right? But then if you wanted to see him, you had to throw flour on him. You know, and then you could see his outline, right? And I feel like a lot of times when we're talking about these connection phenomenon, it's like throwing flour on the invisible man. So hopefully through our reflections here and some of our stories, we'll be able to, you know, get some flour from three different angles here. And you can get to see the invisible person for a second. That is the quiet mind. And yeah, I wondered, Sarah, if you had reflections on the quiet mind, because I know you are in that state quite a lot.
Yeah, it's an elusive critter to track. So I guess the first way that I would want to kind of talk around it is the difference between the quiet mind and like empty mind or blankness. So what do we mean by quiet mind? It's not necessarily that we've kind of gone off into a daydream, right? And where we've kind of spaced out or we're locked into our screen and our mind is preoccupied in a particular way that can feel like a quiet mind, that kind of absence of mind, right? But really, I feel like the quiet mind is steeped with awareness. So with a sense of, or an experience of being fully present in the moment and with our kind of mental chatter being quiet, right? And then this other aspect of our mind emerges, which could be described as pure awareness, where you're hearing the birds and smelling the air and feeling the earth beneath your feet and with a sense of stillness versus the analytical mind that wants to, you know, maybe identify all the flowers around us or, you know, ask the question, what direction is the wind coming from? Or where is this trail leading me? Who made this track? And so I say it that way because I look at it like we have these different aspects of mind. And it's not to say the analytical mind or the mental mind is bad or not as good as the quiet mind. I think it's really important to honor that we have this mental aspect and then we have this quiet mind, this kind of stillness part, and they function differently, and they also work really well together, or they have the capacity to work really well together. For example, if I'm out tracking and I find some fresh tracks, I'll go into that quiet mind space of just awareness in that moment. And then my analytical mind might come up with a question, like, where was this animal going? And I can hear that question. I can, you know, maybe even intentionally form a question or look for a question and then let that go and go back into the quiet mind and see what kind of experience or pull or sensory cues I might receive. And so this is this kind of awareness of different types of mind I see in meditation practices, where it's often encouraged to not try to fight against your mental mind while you're meditating, but to observe your thoughts, right? And to just let them float by. And in that practice, I think we start to really learn, like, oh, this is, we start to be able to pinpoint, oh, that's that mental aspect of myself. And I think what has happened in modern times is that mental part has kind of taken the reins, you know, and takes us on these mental journeys cyclically and nonstop. So can we learn to acknowledge that part of ourselves and kind of at the same time acknowledge the quiet part that can observe those thoughts and then stay with that quiet part? Like, what is that quiet part actually experiencing?
That was really well said. And I'll just let the listeners know that Sarah is a very experienced meditator as well as a holistic tracker and healer. So you have a lot of experience with meditation.
Indeed. Yeah. I spent about 10 years meditating at least an hour a day. And, you know, that sounds like a harsh discipline. And this was like sitting inside meditation, kind of the traditional way we think of meditating. But I did that, and I still do it frequently, although now I've transferred a lot of that time to outside dynamic meditation. But to sit for an hour every morning was purely out of my own intrinsic motivation, because once I hooked into what the quiet mind was, it was this unfolding portal, as John described it in the intro, of experience. Finding that quiet mind while I was in a controlled space really empowered me to take it out on the landscape and be able to discern what quiet mind meant while I was opening up my senses to the environment and everything that was happening around me.
This is really making me think about how the quiet mind related to my music journey. And I think where I'll start is I remember when I first started playing in a rock band, the parts are really precise and it's easy to get lost, especially on, you know, the more difficult songs. And I remember struggling with it because I would make a mistake and then I would go, oh gosh, I made a mistake. And I would like entertain that thought. And then of course I'd make another mistake and I would have this sort of cascade of mistakes. So maybe instead of missing a couple of notes, I actually lost, you know, 5 or 10 seconds of the song. You know, I'm sure it wasn't that long, but it felt like forever in the moment. And I learned a lot about just being present and just being fully in the song through that process. And what happened was, as a result of that, of just like being with it and being present to it and sort of allowing the mistake to flow by, observing it, you know, I didn't lose the thread and reached a point after a few years of really working around that where I actually kind of woke up one day and realized, wow, I haven't gotten lost in a song in a long time. I can't remember the last time I got lost, you know, and my practice habits became very similar in that way of, you know, sitting for an hour straight. And usually the metronome is on for, you know, 45 minutes of that hour, perhaps, and just fully immersing myself in the exercise, fully immersing myself in the metronome. And Victor Wooten talks about this idea of actually listening to the beat and trying to give 100% of your attention to the beat and to sort of the outside world, and actually not giving all of your attention to what you're playing, you know, and that would create this incredible silence inside of me, where it was just, you know, almost this experience of oneness with whatever it was that I was playing, and actually feeling the pulse of the music and the pulse of the beat as this external presence that was there and existed beyond sound. And just this wonderful sort of space that I would sink into, which I know, you know, if you look at it from a neuroscience point of view, I'm sure I'm going from beta brainwaves down into alpha brainwaves. And so I actually was in a different brain state, quite literally, from doing that. But just that experience of really feeling one with the music. And it makes me think of something Pat Metheny said, who is this incredible jazz guitar player, and he's known for his improvisation abilities. And what he talks about is that when he's on stage, the way in which he approaches the music is he's like, I just listen as deeply as I can to what everybody is doing and everything that's going on around me. And then the question that I ask is, what would the guitar player do here? And, you know, what would I like to hear the guitar player do here? And then that's what I play. He's like, and it happens to be me that is playing it, but I'm thinking about what would I like to hear? You know, what would I like to hear in the guitar player? And this sort of amazing feeling of almost being the observer of your own actions. You know, when I'm having my best jam sessions or really digging into the music, that's the experience of it. It's like, I'm almost the audience and the player at the same time. And that ability to sort of go to that space in my mind is only possible after I really immerse myself in my senses, immerse myself in listening, immerse myself in the feeling under my fingers. And there's really no room for thoughts in there. But as they emerge, of course, which, you know, is bound to happen because that's just part of being human, that I'm allowing them to just sort of gently float by and returning to that presence.
Yeah, music and nature have so much overlap, as, you know, author and Grammy Award winning bassist Victor Wooten says in The Music Lesson, which is an incredible audiobook if you haven't heard it. He really brings a lot of these principles. Victor's very aware of the quiet mind. And he talks about, you know, the language of nature and the language of music being so similar, so overlapping. And there's some really, I've seen him do some wonderful stuff on that topic. You know, and I think, you know, the idea of music and the dance, you know, when I was talking with Dr. Bill Sutherland, who spent some time with the San Bushman Healers in Namibia and the Kalahari, with Dr. Brad Keeney, he brought back a story to me about these three kind of like core strands of commitment. You know, if you're going to be a helpful member of your village, a helpful member of the family, these are three things that you're going to do every day because we're all doing it. It's like our commitment, you know, it's like a cultural core commitment. And the first one is that when we're out on the landscape, we're not out there for ourselves. You know, I'm not out just walking around trying to entertain myself. Like if I'm out on the landscape because I'm out with my grandmother gathering, you know, she's gathering berries and she's digging up roots to bring back to the family. And I'm, you know, the little kid tagging along with her, I am responsible, and that's imbued in me from a young age. I'm responsible to use all my senses because I might see something, hear something, feel something, smell something that will be really important for everyone to know. And so my first commitment is that I'm going to use all my senses, as Aidan said. So this is one of the techniques to get into the quiet mind, and this idea of dynamic meditation versus static meditation that Sarah was pointing out and Aidan was pointing out in the music example. Your movement on the landscape combined with pulling in all the information in your senses brings you into the quiet mind because there's a need greater than you, which is something that Tom Brown emphasizes, my mentor, you know, that when we're out on the land with a need greater than ourselves, like for instance, I'm out here, but I'm here to pay attention. So when my grandmother asks me questions when I get back, I'll be able to tell her what I saw, what I smelled, what I felt, what, you know, whatever. And that information all weaves back together in the second commitment, which is I have to live that story anew for my people when I get back to the village. So if I'm carrying a useful bit of information that I absorbed through my senses when I was out there, now I get to relive that story for everyone and bring them to the place where I had that experience so they can fully experience the story and get that information fully rooted in themselves, because all of us need to know all we can about this place around us, right? So that's the second commitment. And the third commitment is more elusive to talk about, but it's directly linked to the quiet mind, and that is the dance. They call it the dance. And that gets confusing, except when you hear the Bushmen say, like in the movie The Great Dance that Craig and Damon Foster put out back, you know, late 90s, early 2000s, you know, tracking is like dancing because our body is happy. You can feel it in the dance. The hunting will be good. So if you take that and you break that down, you know, tracking is like dancing because our body is happy, right? It's not our mind is happy. Our body is happy. So if you follow Bushmen while they're hunting and tracking, like I have done on many, many occasions, the whole time they're moving, their hands are making gestures. And the gestures are, if we're following a set of kudu tracks, for instance, which is a pretty large antelope, and we're following those kudu tracks, the lead tracker who's walking along the kudu track that we're following, his hand is gesturing with every track that passes by under his gaze. His eye is straight ahead on the horizon, and he's in peripheral vision or wide-angle vision, but he's seeing the tracks in the lower part of his peripheral vision, but he's not looking down at them. He's keeping his arm out in front of him, and his body is dancing with the movements the animal was making while it was leaving those tracks. So you can see this is the dance, you know, that I'm talking about. It's like we're getting information from that part of, you know, that part of the mind that Sarah described as the observer. You know, I'm watching myself have these thoughts. So who am I? I am the observer watching myself think. You know, and when the thoughts stop happening, I'm still here. It's not like I remember a young teenager who was really terrified to go into this quiet mind because he thought if he wasn't thinking, he would be dead. So he was identifying so strongly with his thoughts. Whoa, if my thoughts stop, that means I'm dead, right? So it's interesting because we can really identify with that thinking part of our mind as if that's us. But when we tune into the observer and that thinking mind kind of relaxes and slows down and maybe even stops because we're trying to listen and observe with our eyes and feel the wind, smell the air, and doing all that at the same time as we're moving across the landscape. And especially if we have a need greater than ourselves, okay, I'm going to come back and tell the story of my experience to my people when I return. That puts me even more into the moment. And now my body starts to feel things as I move. You know, I can literally turn my walk into a dance, right? So the Bushmen are literally communicating the energy they're picking up through the tracks, but through everything. I mean, I watch them when we're walking and the grass blows the wind. The wind is blown by the grass in a particular way. And I watch a couple of Bushmen sort of imitate it spontaneously in the moment. You know, they're in the dance. And then when they get back later and after the storytelling is done, the fire is lit, they go into the dance. And now they actually dance what they had said in words earlier with body gestures, you know. So, you know, this is all related to the quiet mind. And if I may just share one more short story about what happens when we don't have the quiet mind and what we miss. There was an elder man who heard me give a talk one evening about tracking in bird language. And I was talking about the quiet mind. I was talking about tracking and the intersection between being aware of, you know, the waves that come off a hawk when it moves and how when the hawk is approaching in a hunting intent, it causes the songbirds to behave this way and it moves across the landscape for 200 yards. And so if you're at the 200-yard mark, you know the hawk is there 200 yards away by paying attention to the waves of body language and behavior and movement in these birds and animals. And, you know, I said, so if you're tracking and you're following, say, a bobcat, you know, and it's a fresh trail and you want to know where that bobcat went, and you don't listen for the bird language, you're going to miss where the bobcat is right now. Because right now you're following the tracks of where it was a while ago. But where is it right now? And it's that bird language that tells you, okay, there's a Bewick's wren alarm over there, and there's a towhee alarming over there, and it's down low, and it is in the direction that this bobcat was traveling. But I see that the bobcat is now aware of me, and it's now moving to the left to go down that steep hillside, right? This is, you know, I was kind of telling stories like that. And this elder man comes up to me and he says, you know, would you be willing to mentor my son in tracking? And so I said, well, I don't know. I mean, we'll have to meet and talk and see if your son's even interested, you know, cause I don't know, you know? So the son was my age. I was about 35 years old at the time. And I went out for a walk with this man and I said, you know, in exchange for, you know, me spending time with you, could you show me some cool places that you know about? Because he grew up there and I was fishing and hunting since he was a little boy. He knew all these cool places and I wanted to see the cool places, you know? So he thought that was a totally awesome exchange. He was excited about it. But one day he was walking in front of me. This is one of our first times out in the field. And he's walking in front of me down this narrow trail. And there's overhanging blackberry bushes and overhanging Japanese knotweed. And, you know, it's as tall as we are, you know, and you feel like you're walking through this like sort of jungle. Trail is overgrown. And so you can't see your feet because there's too many leaves around and stuff, right? So you're just kind of sometimes even putting your arms up over your head so you don't get caught in the branches, right? Because it gets narrow. So we're going down this trail and he's in front of me about 10 steps. And all of a sudden he goes from that narrow scissoring gait, you know, to be narrow as you can be to go down this trail, where then he lifts his elbow suddenly, he squats down and his legs go wide. And for 2 steps, he's walking like a bear, literally. And then he goes into that narrow gate again. And I said, you know, can you stop, please? And he said, what? I said, can you back up 2 steps? And he said, okay. And I said, now bend down and go under the bushes and look to your left and right and tell me what you see. And he's like, whoa, there's a bear trail here, like a, you know, a tunnel under the brush that you couldn't see from an upright position. He said, did you know it was there? And because I'd never been to this place before, right? So he's really wondering, what the heck did I just do? How did I know it was there? I said, well, no, you told me it was there. I did not tell you it was there. I didn't even know it was there. I said, but your body knew it was there. He said, what are you talking about? I said, you literally started walking like a bear for 2 steps, and then you stopped and went back to the way you normally walk. And he turns and looks at me like, with his head cocked and his eyebrows, you know, his forehead wrinkled and like, this guy's weird kind of thing, or like, what just happened? Like, you know, he was really, I don't even know, confused by that, okay? So we continued walking, and about maybe 20 yards later, the same thing happened, and I told him to stop, and then this time he backed up, he knew exactly what to do, and he looks and he sees another bear trail, and he turns and looks at me and he says, did my body really tell you that that was there? And I said, yeah, it really did. He's like, huh, I think I like this mentoring thing. This is going to be cool, right? So, you know, what's going on in that story is that he identifies with his thoughts so much. He's not even aware of the dance. He's not aware that his body is drawing information into itself. He's not accessing his own quiet mind where he could be the observer and actually notice when his body feels a bear trail, right? Needless to say, after a little bit of coaching, a little bit of practice, he got really good at just sensing bear trails and just immediately knowing when they were there. And he just got, you know, he like blew by me in confidence, like immediately. Once he understood, oh, this part of me knows, I will tune into that part of me, right? So this is what the Bushmen are talking about when they say the dance. You know, tracking is like dancing because your body is happy, but your body isn't just happy. Your body is receiving all this information that moves through it. So your body's kind of like almost like a meter of what's happening. And if we get in the quiet mind, then we're able to access that more fully. And then it gets really, really fun, really fun.
It sounds like what you're saying is that our practice is really to get out of our own way, that in order to be the observer, that the observer is allowing for things to be received. But if we're putting too much noise in the signal, we're never going to notice that they're received in the first place. So I'm hearing thoughts certainly can get in the way of that. And I'm sure also there are so many external distractions and our ability to, you know, plug in all the time if we wanted to, because of the ubiquity of cell phones and the internet and just constant entertainment. So there's lots of noise that can get put into the signals. But when we quiet ourselves down and we open up into our senses, and it sounds like we're focusing our mind on our sensory awareness and on the present moment, and that allows us to open up to these other messages that we can receive.
I mean, that's it in a nutshell. I was curious, when I was about 18 or 19 years old, I ended up working at an ashram in upstate New York. I was friends with a martial artist who's also really into meditation, and he liked to go to this monastery and in the Catskills. And so they would offer, you know, really good food and a place to stay and meditation classes and different yoga classes and things like that. And I thought, but he wanted me to come and teach nature connection activities in exchange for, you know, room and board and the ability to take workshops. So I thought, well, that sounds fun. So I went up there. It was a weekend, and I took this meditation class, and I was really confused. I sat in the back of the room, and I'm listening to the meditation teacher, and I really like his presentation. It's really good. And he seems to be talking about a state of mind that the people who are taking the class with me are really confused about. Like, he's basically explaining to them, well, you can get to the place where your mind is still and there's no thoughts, and people are raising their hand and asking all these questions about it. And I finally, I was like, what are they talking about? You know, like, I do that all the time. I mean, you need a class to learn how to do this? Like, I was confused. Why did I know how to do this? Like, why did I take it for granted? Like, I walk around in that state all the time. And why is it that nobody else seems to know that they can do that? And how did that happen to me? And why didn't it happen to them? And then I tracked that back, and it brought me back to when I was 12 years old. And I had an experience while sitting in nature at what I call a sit spot. Back then, I didn't have a name for it. It was a place that my mentor, Tom, had asked me to go every day for at least, you know, in the beginning, 20 minutes, and then it was 40 minutes, and then at least an hour. And I'd been doing that for a couple of years, and just kind of dropping into that super relaxed, open awareness state. And I'd finally gotten to the place where I began to notice bird language. And I heard some birds making alarms behind me, and they were going in a straight line from south to north. And I crawled into the thicket after the bird alarms had passed, and I found a tunnel, like a bear tunnel, but this was much smaller. It turned out it was a wild animal trail that raccoons and foxes were using. And what had passed me that day, unbeknownst to me at the time, was a red fox, and it was heading north. So I followed the sounds of alarms to the north, and I could see a faint trail from all the dirty raccoon feet that had walked back and forth and put a stain on the leaves. And I got to the sand road where the animal trail crossed the sand road, and there on the ground was a fresh fox track and a fresh fox scat. And I talked to Tom about it. Later, I actually ran to his house. I was so excited by it. And he said, you know, you said there was no spider webs on that trail through the bushes that you crawled on. I said, right. He said, do you think that trail is used every day by wild animals? And I said, yeah, definitely. And then he said, well, do you think that's the first time that fox passed by you? You've been sitting here for close to 1,000 days, John. And I'm like, probably not. He said, are you going to let that fox get the better of you? If I was you, I would try to get the better of the fox, which was the perfect thing to say to a 12-year-old who was interested and curious. And from that point on, I listened so hard all the time for what the birds were saying that my mind literally just switched off, but I didn't notice it switching off. It wasn't like I was trying to meditate. It was that total passion and curiosity about what are the birds saying and what does it mean? Is there a fox? And that little set of questions brought me right into the quiet mind. And so by the time I was 19, it was just always with me. And, you know, and it confused me that people were taking a class. So I think what I'm saying is, you know, that the portal into the quiet mind is like this curiosity about what am I hearing? What am I feeling? What am I sensing? What am I smelling? You know, what's the wind doing? What are the birds doing? What's that deer doing? And just expanding out as much as you can your senses into this big sphere of detection that you're monitoring in all directions all the time. And, you know, if you go to a sit spot every day, the same place every day, and you get to know the trees and the birds and the animals, over time, you will sink into this place. You know, it's not something that happens your first time out. In fact, first time out at my sit spot, I'm like, what am I doing here? This is stupid. I'm just sitting here. You know, I'm bored. I'm sticking a stick in the ground and making holes and throwing sticks. And, you know, like there was no sensibility for it. But over time, it grew on me. And, you know, that I'm sure contributed to my ability to get to that quiet mind, the slowing down to nature's time, to earth time, to the present moment, noticing things that I'm curious about, you know. So, you know, that was, you know, what clearly brought me into the quiet mind was those practices, especially bird language. And I still think it's one of the best. I still think it's one of the best.
It's such a great example of how nature can be our teacher and our trainer, right? And how it's not about getting rid of the cognitive mind or the intellectual mind, but really training the quiet mind, right? Training this other aspect of our mind, training our awareness, right? Expanding out in our awareness into, as you described, John, drops us into internal stillness. And so I see people struggle with trying to stop their mind, right? I can't stop my mind. And then when I think about stopping my mind, I get stuck in that loop, right? So instead of just sitting and trying to stop the thoughts, kind of redirecting attention, right? Like sitting, being at your sit spot, acknowledging, yeah, the qualms of the day and the week are amongst me, but then saying also there's this bird song, and just taking the time and making the conscious choice to redirect attention to our sensory experience in nature, especially, right? In that purity of nature where we evolved our sensory awareness, right? I think a lot of people have toned down sensory awareness because of the stimulation of a modern world. So as we go into developing the quiet mind and some of these awareness practices, we'll start to have this discomfort, an uncomfortable feeling of, ooh, I'm starting to feel more. And I actually don't really know if I'm safe feeling more. But when we practice in nature, we are usually met with experiences that are pleasing to our senses, right? That make us want to go on that journey of being fully present and finding curiosity. So like tracking, as John was describing, that the pull of curiosity just quiets the mind, right? If I'm on a trail and I'm really interested in engaging with what my activity is, then that other part of my mind just drops away. And I hear that also in what Aiden was sharing with music, right? The full, being fully present with how my fingers are touching the strings and how the strings are connecting to the fret and the sound that that's making, and then the sound that the other people are making with their instruments. There's really no room for analysis, right? When we're fully in the moment. And I think this is where we get into that flow state that people talk about, where we're fully present, we're fully in our body, and there's this sense of of something more moving through, and the sense of another part of us functioning where we're not making cognitive linear choices to do certain things, to press the, you know, to make the correct formation of my hand, to make the chord, to make the sound, or to, you know, suddenly stand up and look to the east and see the bobcat, right? There's this other awareness, this other intelligence that we learn to tap into. And it does not have to be in opposition to our cognitive mind or our intellectual mind. It actually is meant to work in concert with. So for people out there that are, you know, intimidated by meditating or sitting at a sit spot, like John's describing how boring it could be, you know, if you're just stuck in the woods, like, why am I here? What am I supposed to do? I have things to do. What time is it? You know, I've got this grocery list. I've got, you know, people I need to call, or, you know, I really want to get on my Facebook page. Like, so that can all be there. And when we can learn to say, okay, that's fine. I'm going to take 5 minutes to like really focus on this rock and like actually look at it and feel it and smell it and be with it, and let it be small moments, right? Where we just create a choice to redirect our attention, especially in nature, and let that build over time, where innate curiosity will spring up eventually, right? And then whatever that movement is in your being, like, oh, I'm actually really curious about how the St. John's wort is doing right now. Is it ready to bloom? Is it blooming? Is it ready to, you know, make an oil with? Whatever one's curiosity might be, will actually take us into quiet mind. The journey of connection and being in sensory awareness and being in the flow with nature. So it's interesting how quiet mind can feel like boring or dull or empty, right? When really, what we're talking about is this amazing experience of connection it's dynamic and fluid and engaged and feeling fully alive. So I hope that hits people, the knowing that this is not like we're leaving, we're going into a cave, you know, we're going to not talk, we're going to be very stoic and, you know, discipline and put that mind away in a cage. It's not what it is. It's understanding that mind is actually really important. And that mind is actually how we get little insights through the filter of that mind. But we can learn how to be in the quiet mind, in this place of presence where we can then receive those bits of data that might inform us in mysterious ways.
I love the way you described that, Sarah. And one of the themes that I think you're pointing towards is the nature of that analytical mind. And is that, you know, we need something to focus on, you know, even when you think about, you know, transcendental meditation or meditation where you are sort of removing yourself from the sensory environment, we still find something to focus on. We focus on a mantra, or we focus on our breath, and that actually focusing that part of our mind towards something frees us up to be fully present and to be in our senses and to be with our body, you know, and I think the other thing that I would add, you know, for me right now, living in quite an urban environment, like even as we're sitting here during this interview, my window, my desk looks out over the neighborhood, and there's been three or four different landscaping trucks that just drove up and parked, and they're starting a project outside, and cars are going by. And, you know, there's a lot of sort of man-made happenings right now going on. And there's also a couple of titmice that have been going back and forth to the feeder and have been scolding each other. And I've been noticing the wind through the trees. And you know, that also that focus piece that we have allows us not only to focus into our senses, but also through that, we can focus toward the things that we are interested in observing. You know, I know for me as a musician, I find myself listening to music in a particular way, focusing on particular elements of that. But within our environment, even in the city, there are trees, there are birds, there are things that are happening, and we can choose to focus our awareness and our attention towards the things that we enjoy, you know, as well as focusing out and just asking that question of, okay, what's happening around me But I, you know, for me, that my closing thought is just the nature of our mind sort of struggling with the negative space. We don't do well with not that, right? Don't think about a pink elephant. Well, you all just thought about a pink elephant, right? So we have to put something there to focus on. And what's going on in our senses and in this moment all around us is a wonderful default.
Tracking is like dancing because your body is happy. You can feel it in the dance, right? So what is tracking? You know, Sarah is quite literally talking about following animal trails. But I think the most important thing that is being lifted up here, besides the, you know, the sensory immersion techniques, is that sense of curiosity that is coming from your core. So anytime we're curious and it's coming from that internal, like sort of from your gut as opposed to from your head, because there's intellectual curiosity and then there's like core curiosity, right? When a child sees a crayfish for the first time, you can just see their body just go like, whoa, and like their whole body is like totally curious, right? That's what I'm talking about, right? And some people would call that passionate curiosity, right? But whatever, it's coming, it's an embodied sense of curiosity. And whether you aim it at that little insect that landed on your pollinating butterfly bush that, you know, you have out in your yard, and you see this cool little shiny golden sort of bee-like thing, and you're just like totally curious about it. Or you see a new wildflower you haven't seen on your walk before, and you just like, wow, what is this? This is, oh, cool, check it out. Wow. And you look at it from different angles, right? It's like, oh, what is that sound? Oh, I can't. Sounds like a distant waterfall. And then you kind of follow it. And then you find this beautiful waterfall you didn't know was on the landscape because the rainy season made it come alive and you'd never heard it before, right? So, you know, tracking is really just us having questions that are coming from that core kind of childlike place inside of us, right? It's not purely identifying with a mental, you know, kind of curiosity, analytical curiosity. You know, that's cool too, but like Sarah said, these two things can work together really well, and they do work together really well. I think it's one of the elders told me, you know, it's like you want that part of you that is the observer, you know, the one that can feel the dance, to be in the driver's seat and then put the thinking mind in the passenger seat. Don't reverse those things. And I know that Ian McGilchrist talks about that, the master and his emissary. You know, he's talking about two parts of the mind in his work, you know, the same thing. You want that, the part of you that observes yourself thinking, to be the one that's curious. And from there, open your senses and then trust where you feel called to go. And that's kind of the essence of it, you know, in summary. So great conversation. Like I said, we could go for a long time on the quiet mind. And I'll just remind you, you often hear me talk about it as the keystone attribute, because the elder Gilbert Walking Bull, who was consulting with us so many years ago, he's now an ancestor. He passed in 2007, but he was talking to us about these attributes. And he said that, you know, all the attributes of the eight attributes are good. You know, they're sort of equal and you don't know which one's going to rise first. But if you work on the quiet mind, the other ones will rise faster. So he called it the keystone attribute. So I think it's good in this series that we're starting with this one, but we will come back and visit the other seven as well. And we're very likely to come back to this keystone attribute of the quiet mind. Yeah, thank you, Sarah and Aidan, for, you know, your beautiful insights and stories. And thanks for listening.
Thanks, everyone.
Thanks for listening to Tracking Connections. You can find everything related to the podcast and our current offerings at trackingconnections.net. We'll see you next time.